On Being is brought to you by the John Templeton Foundation. The Templeton Foundation harnesses the power of the sciences to explore the deepest and most perplexing questions facing humankind. Learn about cutting-edge research on the science of generosity, gratitude, and purpose at templeton.org/discoveries.
Spiritual border crossing and social creativity. These were some of the echoes in a conversation between Shane Claiborne and Omar Saif Gobash. Though they are two humans with very different stories, they've both lived with some discomfort within the religious group to which they belong and have chosen and continued to love. Omar is a diplomat of the United Arab Emirates and author of Letters to a Young Muslim. One of his responses to the politicization of Islam in the early century has been to bring a new art gallery culture, places for thought and beauty, to Dubai. Shane Claiborne is a singular figure in evangelical Christianity as a co-founder of The Simple Way, an intentional neighborhood-based community in North Philadelphia. One of the things he's doing now is to adapt the biblical commandment to turn swords into plowshares for modern times.
You know, I just spent 40 days traveling around the country melting guns into tools, but there's something that happens at the forge that goes beyond words. It moves the heart to see folks from different faiths, from different backgrounds that come and take the same hammer and beat a piece of metal that was designed to kill into a piece of metal that is designed to cultivate life.
Shane, an indelicate question. What is the time between receiving the guns and actually converting them into something artistic?
About 10 seconds.
Okay, good.
You know, there's all these Christian pastors that keep telling their people to bring guns to church. And they
really?
You know, like, because we should have guns in church. We're like, this is insane. So we have BYOG Sundays, bring your own gun. But we lay them on the altar and we melt them down. And we don't let 10 minutes go by without chopping one of those in half. So, yeah, so they come with a gun. They leave with a plow.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. This conversation took place at the invitation of Interfaith Philadelphia. We met in a synagogue, Congregation Rodef Shalom, in a month that had been preceded by violent global attacks on a synagogue, a mosque, and a church. Just before I came out here, I checked Twitter. I'm sorry to say that I do that a little obsessively at times. And this is what came up. Someone named Kasim Rashid saying, "My faith and my duty as a neighbor command me. If any synagogue in Virginia needs help with security, I'll stand guard. An attack on a synagogue is an attack on all houses of worship." And then Rabbi Latz replied to him saying, "And if your mosques need us to stand guard, I'm there, my brother, I'm there. Our love is stronger than their hate." So my point is, this too happens on Twitter, and this too is the story of our time. Tonight, what I want us to engage on is less about what you stand over against than the generative story that you are both trying to write and make for the beyond of this moment. How the traditions and communities that you are distinctively part of shape the lives you lead and the lives you're working to influence, and how you understand your traditions and the lives you live within them to distinctively contribute to the reality of this moment of great global tumult, in which each of us is working out our lives of faith and theology and spirit as civic beings. I want to start, Omar, with you. I have this question I always ask whoever I'm speaking with, which is, if I ask you to think about the religious and spiritual background of your childhood, how would you begin to talk about that?
Wow, very complicated then, I'd say.
Yeah, it is complicated.
Yeah.
With you.
If I could just say, on my way here and over the last few days, I've been thinking, I don't necessarily have this, you know, very peaceful or at peace message to come up with. For me, these questions are still very active and still, with every single terrorist incident, I think again and again about the issues that we talk about and we're going to probably talk about tonight. Yeah. So my mother is Russian. She comes from a traditional Russian Orthodox background, even though she grew up in the Soviet Union. My father was a Muslim who died in 1977, Arab Muslim from the Gulf, the Arabian Gulf. And since he died when we were very, very young, it was very difficult to get any kind of moral compass. It wasn't as though we were integrated into a wider community. So I spent a great deal of time trying to understand exactly where we fit into the world. Mm. My Muslim friends, who were more traditionally brought up, were brought up in a very homogeneous community, both parents, Arab, Muslim, they could trace their lineage back, maybe not 100 generations, but at least three. Right. We couldn't do that. And so we were missing that kind of net of meaning. And so I looked for it in literature. I tried to find it in the school mosque. I tried to find it at with my sort of foreign friends. Overall, it was a very, very difficult experience. And when I was about 12, I became incredibly devout to the extent where I describe myself now as a fundamentalist, an extremist, actually. And I discovered, actually, that for that year of extremism, I got actually a bit depressed because I had cut myself off from all of my friends, whether they were Christian, Lebanese, or Muslim, but not devout enough. And it was a miserable year.
I think your book is a letter to a young Muslim, and it's directed to your son, but it's also very much about your father.
Yes.
Who you lost when you were six.
Yes.
He was shot and killed in 1977 at the Abu Dhabi International Airport.
That's true.
And I think the shooter was a young Palestinian, and actually the intended target was a Syrian minister.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's very moving how I feel like in the act of writing to your young son, you also excavated part of yourself. You have these ages, these numbers, these ages that were thresholds for you coming out of that experience. And one of them was six. Mm-hmm. That when your son turned six, you could see how he was at six, and that's how old you were when you lost your father.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
And then 19.
19. 19 is the age of the young man who killed my father. And it was at that age that I said to myself, I looked forward to that age to ask myself whether I could conceive of taking up a weapon and killing somebody. And when I reached that age, and I was like, I'm still a child. I have no idea what's right and wrong in this world, but I do know that you can't do that. And so that is also, that was a big kind of age for me.
Mm. Well, there's more to talk about. We'll keep talking. Shane, many years ago I asked you this question about how you start to describe the religious or spiritual background of your life. What I think is a little bit magic about that question is that it changes depending on where you are in your life. So I'm curious how you would start to talk about that now.
Well, I grew up, as you know, down south. I've still retained a little of my southern charm after 20 years in Philly, but I mean, it was the Bible Belt, and we had Christian music, Christian bumper stickers. We even had Christian candy that was testaments. Kid you not, you can't make mints wrapped in a Bible verse. And that was my world. And somehow, through all the clutter of that, I did fall in love with Jesus. And that's my tradition growing up was the United Methodist Church. But then it felt a little like lifeless at times, so I levitated towards a Pentecostal church in the town, and I got rebaptized because they didn't do the sprinkling thing. You had to go all the way underwater, so I had to do it again, But I really just kept leaning in, falling deeper in love with Jesus and seeing the Spirit sort of moving in different traditions. And then I really began to find myself conflicted with a lot of the things that had come to characterize evangelical Christianity. Ironically, you know, we also had country music down south, so it was like, you know, we had songs, "This house is protected by the good Lord and a gun, and if you come uninvited, you'll meet them both, son." Like, that was, so I saw, it's like, wow, this is different, you know, and you know, people think of evangelical Christians, and they think anti-gay, anti-women, pro-death penalty, pro-military, pro-guns, and those things, the deeper I fell in love with Jesus, the more I felt myself at odds with many of those kind of political values. And I ended up coming up here to Philadelphia and continuing my quest towards my faith, and learned a lot from Catholics, worked in India for a while with Mother Teresa. So I've just kind of kept learning what it means to be Christian. And I found that a lot of Christians are good at defining what we believe, but not translating that into a real way of living. And that's why we worship Jesus, but we don't always do the things he told us to do. So that's the last 20 years. We've been forming a little community here on the north side of Philly, which I invited Omar to next time you're in town. And you know, but we love it.
And talk about the origin story of A Simple Way.
Yeah.
Started in 1995 with you and I think some other students becoming aware of dozens of homeless families who'd moved into an abandoned church in North Philadelphia and were being told that they had to get out or be arrested.
Yeah, Eastern University, where I went, is about a half hour outside of the city, and we had read in the newspaper, I'll never forget, one of my friends just came and threw down this newspaper and said, "You got to look at this." And what the newspaper article talked about was the response of the Catholic Church, which was that they had 48 hours to get out or they could be arrested for trespassing. Something about that just didn't quite feel right, you know? And so, but these families hung a banner on the front of the cathedral and it said, "How can we worship a homeless man on Sunday and ignore one on Monday?" And it was catalytic for us. Many of us organized a student movement at our college and others and really came to stand in solidarity with those families who lived there for months and months, and many of them got housing. They're incredible friends and heroes of mine to this day. And it was out of that that we, ironically, in the ruins of that abandoned Catholic church, our vision for what it really means to be church and to live out our faith was born, you know, out of that. We kind of said, let's stop complaining about the church that we see and work on becoming the church that we dream of.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today, a live conversation with Shane Claiborne and Ambassador Omar Saif Gobash. You two can speak to each other. So if you want to jump in and ask a question or respond to something that the other says, you don't have to be dependent. Go through me. So I want to talk about something that I think is quite different. One impatience I have sometimes with kind of simplistic ideas about what it means to have a civil conversation is that somehow we just celebrate what we have in common and don't actually focus on our really beautiful and fast, like the particularities that in fact make us interesting to each other. Seems to me there's a core dynamic in the trajectory the two of you have been on, which is quite different. So for you, Shane, I mean, you've said somewhere that the critical piece of formation in your path and for A Simple Way is the discovery of community. And yet for you, Omar, there's this tension between revelation and reason. And for you, the countercultural move is actually asserting the importance of the individual.
Yes, exactly. Well, a few days ago, somebody said to me, as a political figure, he said, "You're a rebel." And I said, "No, I'm not a rebel. I just don't like groupthink." And he said, "Exactly, you're a rebel, right?" I get worried when everybody in a room agrees on something because I think you're hiding something or there is something you don't see, and it just doesn't feel healthy. And so I need to push back. But it's also because I feel that, especially with the rise of the internet and all of these social technologies, even before social media, there was, in a sense, a discovery of the world around us. And as we were growing up in the Middle East, it was a very bleak kind of existence, a very bleak outlook, very little color in it. And all of a sudden, you saw all of these different things that could entice you, that right. sort of set off buttons that allowed you to begin to say, actually, I identify with these things and not with those. And you know, we all wear the same clothes in the Gulf countries. Yeah, all the men dressed in white, we all look the same. All the women dressed in black, they all look the same. No sign of any individuality. But as you observe people, you begin to see these tiny instances of individuality, and I think that's a growing movement. And if it's being displayed in our outer form, it's certainly bubbling up underneath. And I think that's something also the political authorities are beginning to understand. It's taking place, but they have no idea how to really relate to it. As you see, you know, the change in leadership in Algeria, the protests in Sudan recently, right. all of this is a sign of people wanting to live their lives, not the life that the community insists that they lead.
Right. Jane, talk about, you know, because in this culture of extreme individualism, there's some place you described. Oh yeah, when you started The Simple Way, you talked for many, 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 many hours, summing up the entire mission as love God, love people, and follow Jesus. But then you
it took us a long time to get back to that. Yeah.
Okay, but then over the years now, you've had to put so much flesh on those bones, and the balance between orthodoxy and orthopraxis, what is believed and what is lived, but that the holder of all of that is community, the accountability is community, and it's kind of un-American.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think of community and I think of God, in my own faith journey, I've come to see God as an expression of community. And I mean, we would talk about that as creator, son, spirit. You know, that there's this kind of dynamic of God that is communal, and we're made in the image of God. And when the first human is made and the breath is breathed into the dirt, it's not pronounced really good until they're helping one another. So that communal image is there from the beginning. But I think what I like related to this, what I would say is that oneness doesn't mean sameness, and unity doesn't mean uniformity, but actually the most powerful unity happens in the midst of diversity. So I like saying that we are about harmonizing but not homogenizing, right? We're all kind of singing in a symphony, and it's beautiful because there is a diversity. Rabbi Arthur Waskow from Philadelphia, great teacher and hero in our city, he talks about sameness as the way of empires and corporations. Everything is uniform, but the Creator made diversity. So all of us have a unique fingerprint and DNA, and there's this beautiful diversity built into everything that God has made. So I love that. It's also part of why we have so much division, I think, is we can't find that unity in the midst of it. So it's a wild dichotomy, right? Even in the Christian church, I mean, we wrote this book of prayer called Common Prayer, and as we were trying to bring Christian traditions together, we found out that there are over 30,000 Christian denominations. And Jesus' longest prayer is that we would be one as God is one. You're like, wow. We got to get this thing together. So, so I think that's part of the tension that we.
Yes,
hold.
And there's something utterly natural about that too, right? Even as it makes things very challenging. Here's some lines from Letters to a Young Muslim that I love. Life is diverse. Living is to live with difference. Anyone telling you that difference should be stamped out is stamping out life. Those people insisting that there are black and white answers to the difficult questions are stamping out the diversity that is inherent within us.
Mm. Yeah, thank you. I liked it too.
I think we should collect questions. Just pass them down. Okay.
Can I just respond also?
Yeah.
I'm not against community. I just want community to expand its sense of who can belong.
Oh, I know you're not against community.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's just that the emphasis for you is different.
I had to justify my individuality since I felt excluded from the community right from the start. I had no choice but to accept that I was different. People can be very idealistic about their values, but when push comes to shove, I had a Russian mother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it mattered. And no matter how hard I tried, you're not fully a member. And so I began to sort of, rather than persecute and torment myself for being different, I realized I couldn't be responsible for my parents' choices, but I could redefine the value. And I could actually begin to say, actually, what I thought was there must be so many people who feel excluded in the same way that I do. Mm-hmm. And I discovered that actually the vast majority of people feel that they're excluded and they have to, you know, sort of bow down and submit to some leader type mentality out there.
And something that you also come back to again and again in your letters to your sons just gets at one of the, I say, a very mysterious tension about being alive. And you're a diplomat, which to me fits with this, that you know that you were saying, and Shane, you do this in your own way too, reality is complex. And the moral challenge is very often in areas of gray. It's very often where the black and white answers, which we all actually long for and which our traditions sometimes provide, where that's not enough, where we still have to develop moral conscience and make complicated decisions to live with the world as it is and not as we wish it to be.
Well, I noticed that amongst very kind of extreme preachers in the Islamic world, they'll often talk about the beauties of nature and, you know, how they want to withdraw into the mountains or into the countryside and live like that. And I think, well, that's all great, but you're not actually testing your faith in the city, where really that's where life is really complicated, and you should be helping people to actually achieve their faith in complex environments. Mm. I hope I persuaded you with that.
That's good. I was just thinking, you know, there's a lot of those same tendencies in the Christian tradition too. There's a lot of communities that pull themselves out of society try to be this utopian kind of thing. And that was true even in Jesus's day. These folks that would, you know, the Essenes and other groups that kind of moved out of the world. And Jesus's teaching is that we would be light in the darkness is at the very heart of what community. And community is, for me, a part of that is like the way that you put a fire out is by scattering it out, and the way that you keep a fire alive is by stoking it. So community for us, I think, is about keeping that fire alive. And it's easy to blow out a candle, but hard to put out a fire. And I think the intersectional justice and all the stuff that we're talking about is finding ways that we can sing the same song of love right now.
Mm-hmm. I also think, as a journalist, that this narrative, this reality, the fire, you know, that you say it's bigger than we realize, and the story you're telling about this quiet evolution that is happening, that's not in the New York Times today.
No, it's not.
No. We also have to take as seriously the generative narrative, the things that are going right. And actually, yeah, in journalism, which is the official way we tell the story of our time, we absolutely privilege the catastrophic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I heard someone say we don't cover planes that land.
Right.
And, you know, if it bleeds, it leaves. I think in the Christian church, too, it's very clear that some of the loudest voices haven't been the most beautiful. And some of the beautiful voices haven't been amplified like they should. And mm-hmm. I think that's true in almost every tradition. You know, we've had extremists for hatred that no one kills with more passion than when they think God is on their side. And so they've hijacked the headlines with hatred. And you can have one pastor in Florida that burns the Quran, and all of a sudden, like, that hijacks the narrative of what Christians
believe. But that's such a good example, because that pastor in Florida who burned the Quran, the evangelical community of that city rallied against that,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And that story didn't get told.
Right.
It was this one outlier, and he got all the investigation and all the coverage, as though that told the story of the whole, which it didn't. There's so much of that.
That's why we like On Being.
Yeah. yeah. 1 hour a week.
After a short break, more with Shane Claiborne and Omar Saif Gobash. This conversation was the capstone event of Interfaith Philadelphia's own year of social creativity, including partnerships, major public gatherings, and trainings. Their year of civil conversations was inspired by and drew on Being's Civil Conversations Project, especially our 6 grounding virtues and Better Conversations, a starter guide. You can find these and learn more at civilconversationsproject.org.
Support for On Being with Krista Tippett comes from the Fetzer Institute, helping build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Fetzer envisions a world that embraces love as a guiding principle and animating force for our lives, a powerful love that helps us live in sacred relationship with ourselves, others, and the natural world. Learn more by visiting Fetzer.org.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today, spiritual border crossing and social creativity with evangelical Christian innovator Shane Claiborne and Ambassador Omar Saif Gobash of the United Arab Emirates. He wrote the book Letters to a Young Muslim. Reverend Jesse Garner of the First Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia took questions from a live audience at Congregation Rodef Shalom.
If you could go back to immediately after 9/11, what questions do you wish we had been asking each other then? And are they the same questions that we would ask today?
That's such a good question.
After 9/11, immediately. I'll let you go first.
Shane, you thought about this a lot.
Well, I think after every tragedy, it exposes our character in the midst of the rawness of that. And I was just with some of the Amish community after that. We've been melting guns into plows around the country, and one of those was we melted a gun in the Lancaster, in the area where there was the terrible school shooting in the Amish school over a decade ago, and the response of the Amish was stunning. They were lost a bunch of their kids, but then they went to be with the shooter's family to accompany them in their grief, and they pulled their money together and began to create scholarships for the children of Charlie Roberts that killed their kids, and they went to the funerals together. And out of all of that, there was immense healing that did not ignore the terrible thing that was done, but that did not mirror it either, you know. And I had the chance to meet the mother of Charlie Roberts, and she told the story of this Amish man holding her husband as they just wept together. And we reflected on that. And I think, like, part of what we've got to do is have a chance to ask the questions of how do we live in a world where violence and hatred is real without mirroring the same thing that we're trying to heal the world of, right? So how do we, in fighting the beast, not become the beast? And that's certainly what happened right after 9/11, is we became the very violence that we abhorred. So I think that's what I would hope for, is that we would have a moment to pause and say, like, what is really going to heal the wounds of what happened to us, and how do we respond honoring the anger and fear and pain without extending that trauma and exacerbating those wounds and creating a whole bunch of new victims that lose their kids in the same way we lost ours.
Mm-hmm. You're on.
Oh, wow. Okay, so I've been given a few minutes to think about it. I still haven't made progress. I go back and I was saying, what could we have done? And I think in the Arab world, we should have asked ourselves some serious questions and given ourselves honest answers. The issue was that we said, it's a question of our image in the West, and so we want to go and hire all these consultancies and all these, you know, lobbyists and start thinking about, you know, setting up TV channels. And the reality was that, you know, we had to look at the machine, the religious machine that we had set up, and to a large extent, you know, what was being funded either by governments or by private individuals. And, you know, it may have been just sort of inertia or laziness or, fear of, well, people like me, we didn't have the opportunity to really speak to the right people about what was going on. So again, access to power, and then the security in which you could speak to that power. Those were questions that may have hindered some of the progress that we tried to make. And so, you know, my personal reaction was art gallery, then spending 2 years trying to persuade New York University to open in the Emirates. And The reason for New York University, somebody said, well, why don't you go to Columbia? And I said, because I want it to be downtown. I want downtown to understand us, yeah, where the pain took place. And these were all indirect methods of kind of repairing the damage and allowing us also to reflect on what had happened. Yeah, in the Emirates, we're not particularly responsible for anything. And yet, as Muslims and as people who, I suppose, had maybe turned a blind eye to radical thought and who had treated either as a joke or as something that was to be taken seriously but never conceived of actually taking place, I think that I go back and say, with hindsight, it was grossly negligent on our part.
Mm. How does art in the Middle East bring about change?
Well, my reason for opening an art gallery was because I wanted to access the minds of those around me. I felt that we were always wearing different kinds of masks and we weren't necessarily open to the idea of discussing things, but I wanted to see how people perceived the world around me. And, so there's a lot of what came out initially in the art gallery was very political art, very kind of violence-oriented art or reactions to violence. And I felt that was a little boring, you know, it was a bit obvious. And, you know, we managed to expand, we managed to find artists who were doing other things. And all of a sudden what we realized was actually people started replicating this model of having a gallery that was a platform for artists. And now in that area, we had a warehouse and we were opened illegally. That whole area has now been redesignated as an art district. And kids are actually finding that they're able to express their anger, frustration, the turmoil. They're able to express themselves through art and actually make a living as an artist. And that was always something that was in my mind, that you couldn't be an artist in the Arab world, or at least in our part of the Arab world, because it was inconceivable, just as you couldn't be an economist because there was no data. Yeah, you had to beg the government for data. You couldn't be a philosopher because nobody was interested in listening to you, or because you wouldn't be able to put your ideas out there in the first place. There's no platform. So, I mean, well, art was just one way in which we could tackle those issues. There are a whole bunch of other ways as well.
I was thinking, Shane, I looked at the mission statement. I think of the simple way is together cultivating a neighborhood we can be proud of. And I actually thought, Omar, that this was a version of that.
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't pride. It was a desire to influence the world around myself, yeah, in a way that I could do, because I couldn't change government policy, but I could, with a tiny pinprick, set off a little. Yeah, I mean, the art gallery, I can't believe it's actually survived so long, but it has, and it led to, there was a snowball effect. So that was very exciting.
Mm-hmm. We talk about social change. We need social creativity.
Yeah,
we need social courage.
Yes,
and that's the dimension of this that you're nourishing.
I think I'd agree with that. Yeah.
I think there's a beautiful writer, Walter Brueggemann, that talks about the prophetic imagination. And he says, sometimes we misunderstand the biblical prophets, and we think that they were just trying to foretell the future, but they were actually trying to change the present. They were trying to lead us into a different future, to stir our imaginations, to refuse to accept the status quo as normal and to build something new. And one of the things that the prophets Micah and Isaiah speak of is beating swords into plows and spears into pruning hooks. And that imagination is what kind of stirred our work to invite people to donate guns,
because we don't have a ton of swords,
but we have a lot of guns, you know. And so we invited people to donate them. And, you know, I just spent 40 days traveling around the country melting guns into tools. But there's something that happens at the forge that goes beyond words. It's that imagination, creativity, and it moves the heart to see folks that may not, from different faiths, from different backgrounds, that come and take the same hammer and beat a piece of metal that was designed to kill into a piece of metal that is designed to cultivate life.
Yeah.
And certainly something that, like, I think conservatives and liberals often have in common is that they've lost their imagination and they've lost their joy, they've lost their hope, and we kind of end up rehashing some of the same arguments over and over again.
Shane, an indelicate question. What is the time between receiving the guns and actually converting them into something artistic?
About 10 seconds.
Okay,
yeah,
great.
There's all these Christian pastors that keep telling their people to bring guns to church, and they
really
mean, like, because we should have guns in church. We're like, this is insane. So we have BYOG Sundays, bring your own gun, but we lay them on the altar and we melt them down, and we don't let 10 minutes go by without chopping one of those in half. So, yeah, so they come with a gun, they leave with a plow.
Excellent.
Yeah. I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today with Shane Claiborne and Omar Saif Gobash, who served as ambassador for the United Arab Emirates to France and Russia.
How have relationships with people of other faith traditions impacted your own prayer life?
Mm. Well, in my life, I find that I seek them out. When I was in Moscow, I was in Moscow for 10 years. Some of my closest friends were, you know, from the Lubavitcher community. We got on incredibly well. I loved the sort of nuggets of wisdom that I was showered with, and it was wonderful to reach out to essentially the other side. And I think also when I was at boarding school, my exposure to the sermons we were in chapel almost every day, so there was a sermon every day. It showed me a different way in which you could communicate about faith. And I certainly think that, you know, our part of the world, the traditional kind of sermon on Friday used to be a very, very fiery, aggressive and violent type of denunciation of everybody else. And I, you know, felt that I actually knew everybody else, and I thought that that was unfair. So I think some of that is now sinking into, you know, our own consciousness that, yeah, the other is not so horrible.
Mm. Boy, I learned so much being among Muslim communities as I was in Iraq, and especially like just about the devotion. I'm thinking, my gosh, it was hard for me to like spend 10 minutes in quiet and like hear, you know, multiple times a day this prayer life. And so I learned a lot from that about discipline and centering ourselves in prayer. And the commonality, I mean, I've learned to read my own faith better by listening to others. And one of my rabbi friends, he says, we were talking about the death penalty. He's like, we don't agree on some things, you and I, but the death penalty we totally agree on. He said the Jewish community did away with the death penalty a long time ago. He said, and he talks about how all that worked itself out. And he says, the irony is it's Christians that are abusing Hebrew scripture to justify the death penalty, and you guys have the nagging problem of Jesus to deal with. So I love it. You know, I keep finding my own faith deepened as I talk with others and pray with others.
I think that in fact is the paradox of meaningful interfaith or cross-religious relationship, that that you at one and the same time actually the soil beneath your own feet is richer. Mm. You know your own identity better, and the world is larger because of the existence of this.
I see. It just popped into my head. Last Christmas, I was actually in Moscow, and it was Christmas evening, and I was at a synagogue. They have restaurants in the synagogues there, and I was with one of the chief rabbis. They have two, and it was a very, very strange evening. A Muslim, a Jewish rabbi, and we were celebrating Christmas. So, each in his own way, of course. But
yeah. Is that all the questions from the... Okay. Oh, I want to thank you, Shane, for... you have this language. I feel like with words like interfaith, they don't quite sum it up. And there are a lot of, you know, interfaith. Ecumenical is another terrible word. I remember this Paulus priest saying, ecumenism is that which, if we had a better word for, we would have more of. That was his definition of ecumenism. And I feel like it's so important when we're speaking of these experiences, which in fact are transformative, that we try to always keep a really fresh and vivid ecosystem of words and kind of say what we're saying rather than let these labels. And you have this language, which I feel is a synonym for interfaith, Shane, spiritual border crossing. Mm. Mm. I like that. Mm. I'm just going to ask two more questions. I feel like we've been touching on this, but I want to go a little more deeply into it. And it's true that both Islam and Christianity have a self-understanding of themselves as religions of peace. And we've talked about some of the ways peace is not where we are. But I'd like to know, and you, Omar, you really go into this in the book, you really reflect on this. What would it mean, and what does it mean to you? That the empty phrase doesn't do it, but it can be meaningful. So what does it mean for you, and how does it manifest?
Well, I'm still,
Islam is a religion of peace.
Well, I'm still discovering it. I do realize that it requires more than just individual conviction. It actually requires a political conviction. It requires direction of financial resources, these choices that people can make. It requires, strangely, even regulation, bureaucracies, you know, either taking apart bureaucracies or putting them together. And yeah, what I try to do in my book, in a very sort of short manner, is to almost poke fun at the idea that we're a religion of peace and yet we're at war with ourselves and everybody else. There's, you know, I also think a little about the patriarchal systems that we have in place. I spent a bit of time speaking to, I spent a bit of time in Jordan with very religious people, very, very devout. And, you know, you speak to the head of the family and he was fine with the system. And, you know, Islam is a fantastic thing. We're all about family values. And you speak to the women and they're like, I can't wait to get out of here. You know, it's emotional violence, it's psychological violence. And so when I thought, you know, when you think about peace and you think about, you know, extremism and terrorism, there's also the micro-terrorism, the micro-extremism, mm-hmm. the micro-violence that mm-hmm. takes place within all of these homes. So that's where I really think we need to make some changes, so that we're not so used to the violence that happens in our everyday life that we can then take it out into the broader world. Mm-hmm. I am very, very optimistic, though, given the changes in the political environment in the Gulf States and the Middle East today. But yeah, okay, in the next 100 years, we may make some progress.
Yeah.
One of my friends and Richard Rohr, Father Richard Rohr, he says, the best critique of what's wrong is the practice of something better. And there are lots of versions of Christianity that, to me, they don't look a lot like Jesus. So I see that, and I think one of the questions becomes, whatever our faith is, as we're worshiping God, is it making us more loving? Is it making us more life-giving? And because I think we end up replicating the God that we worship, and so sometimes what's so important is what is the character of the God that we are adoring and loving, and who is hopefully changing us. And so, you know, in community, sometimes you get a lot of donations and you end up, you know, before you drink milk, you want to smell it, you know, have it pass the sniff test. And I think a lot of Christianity doesn't pass the sniff test. It doesn't smell like Jesus. It doesn't feel like love. And for a lot of our faiths, I think that's the question, is does it smell like love? Because no matter what our theology is, if at the end of the day it doesn't help us love more deeply, then I wonder if we're really leaning into the God who, in my faith tradition, says God is love. No one has seen God, but if we love one another, we see God present among us. And so that's really what faith should do to us, I think. And when we see distortions of our faith, that's the power of Muslims that are speaking against ISIS in extremist forms and risking their lives doing that. And I feel the same duty to try to sing a better song than some of the toxic Christianity that has distorted my faith. And what we've seen are some of the deep roots of that are so problematic and so unlike Jesus and the values. But I'm hopeful because I see a whole generation that's rising up. And I think that water doesn't boil one big bubble. It begins to steam and it begins to bubble up. And I see that happening all over our country right now. And people of many different faiths, many different intersections of justice, joining hands and saying, none of us are free until all of us are free. And we may find ourselves at odds with some of the people of our own faith, we will find ourselves joining hands with people of folks of other faith that share in common this vision of love and justice and freedom for everyone.
So in response, I've got to be really brief. I despair at the state of the Arab world. I think the state of the Arab world has obviously a tremendous effect on global Islam. I am hopeful because my sabbatical ends in September, so I'll be back to work.
And you'll take care of it.
Of course.
I don't know why. Why is this event taking me back to the early days of the show? But it is. There was this question when I started speaking about this subject, this aspect of the human enterprise. There was a question about whether that could be relevant to the world. And whether if people did have religious lives, public radio listeners, if they didn't just want to keep it private. We're arguably in a more tumultuous moment now than we were then. And yet I feel like this conversation... Well, first of all, I feel like everything you've been doing in this city for the last year and have poised yourself to keep doing, and this conversation tonight is such a witness that while the institutions of religion, like all of our institutions, are in flux now, all of them are being remade. This voice from deep inside religious tradition, the insights of theology, the wisdom that comes from this relationship with text over millennia, with the conversation across generations that is at the heart of our traditions, is profoundly... relevant is not a big enough word. So I'm really grateful for this demonstration of that. And again, grateful to all of you for creating this space for us to have this vivid reminder. Thank you for having On Being in Philadelphia, and thank you, Shane and Omar. Shane Claiborne is the founder of The Simple Way, an intentional community in North Philadelphia. He's recently written a book, Beating Guns, about the movement he co-leads to transform America's guns into garden tools. His other books include The Irresistible Revolution.
His Excellency Omar Saif Gobash is now the Assistant Minister for Cultural Affairs in the Cabinet of the United Arab Emirates. He was formerly ambassador to France and Russia. His book is Letters to a Young Muslim. Special thanks this week to Abby Stammelman-Hockey, Amanda Skates-Preisinger, and all of the wonderful people at Interfaith Philadelphia. And to Ray Stokes for his wonderful sound engineering support for this event. A grateful shout out also to our longtime friends and partners at WHYY Philadelphia. The On Being Project is
Chris Heagle,
Lily Percy,
Maya Tarrell,
Marie Sambalay,
Aaron Farrell,
Lauren Dordal,
Tony Liu,
Aaron Colasacco,
Kristen Lin,
Prophet Adewu,
Eddie Gonzalez,
Lillian Vo,
Lucas Johnson,
Damon Lee,
Suzette Burley,
Katie Gordon,
Zach Rose,
Siri Grassley,
Nicole Finn,
and Colleen Scheck.
The On Being Project is located on Dakota land. Our lovely theme music is provided and composed by Zoe Keating. And the last voice that you hear singing at the end of our show is Cameron Kinghorn. On Being is an independent production of the On Being Project. It's distributed to public radio stations by PRX. I created this show at American Public Media. Our funding partners include the John Templeton Foundation, harnessing the power of the sciences to explore the deepest and most perplexing questions facing humankind. Learn about cutting-edge research on the science of generosity, gratitude, and purpose at templeton.org/discoveries. The Fetzer Institute, helping to build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Find them at fetzer.org. Kalliopeia Foundation, working to create a future where universal spiritual values form the foundation of how we care for our common home. Humanity United, advancing human dignity at home and around the world. Find out more at humanityunited.org, part of the Omidyar Group. The George Family Foundation, in support of the Civil Conversations Project. The Osprey Foundation, a catalyst for empowered, healthy, and fulfilled lives. And the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interests in religion, community development, and education.
On Being is produced by On Being Studios in Minneapolis, Minnesota.